You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 4th of November 2019. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAryan.com. Well, I am very pleased to say that I have my co-host with me today to start the week with, Mr. Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, how are you doing, sir?
Yeah, I'm doing very well as usual. I think that there are lots of opportunities that will present themselves to us as the months unfold ahead of us. And I'm very optimistic for the future.
How optimistic about our show today as well. This is actually being pre-recorded, so we're not going to be discussing any current news stories. What we're going to be doing is getting on with our Greatest Britain series in talking about first Baron Robert Baden-Powell, which we started last week. We talked a little bit about Baden-Powell, his early life, how he befriended this American scout, this Frederick Russell Burnham, how he played a large role in the idea of scouting. And we ended with Baden-Powell being in South Africa at the start of the Second Matabele War, which we're going to get into now. In March 1896, the Matabele revolted against the authority of the British South Africa Company. The Malemo, the Matabele witch doctor, is credited with fermenting much of the anger that led to this confrontation. He convinced the Matabele and the Shlona, two Negro tribes, that the settlers, almost 4,000 strong by then, were responsible for the drought, the locust plagues, and the cattle disease Rinderpest that were ravaging the country at the time. So we can see there that, no matter what these white men did, I mean, they were building a railway which was going to be benefiting these Africans, they were still going to blame them for things that were completely out of their hands, like drought, locust plagues, things like this. And we can also see that the guy that's actually leading them, the leadership there, is this witch doctor. And I don't think things really change that much today. These witch doctors still have immense power over there in South Africa. And it was this particular witch doctor that led this revolt. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
Only that, as you say, there still is a fair degree of influence over certain African communities from witch doctors. And, you know, from time to time, we read in our newspapers of spates of killings and mutilations that take place, particularly against people that are albinos. There are certain states in Africa where the belief amongst the tribal peoples of that state are that the body parts of an albino have sort of miraculous medical qualities. And so therefore, if somebody is born an albino, and only a very, very small percentage of any population is born albino, but for the unfortunate albinos born in those parts of Africa, they basically are in fear of their lives, because wherever they go, people are constantly trying to chop their foot off or kill them so that they can cut them into pieces and sell the pieces to various witch doctors to make their kind of tribal medicines and things with. And so, you know, that kind of primitive superstitious medicine still exists even in parts of Africa today. And I you know, quite often humorously recall there was a spate of murders that took place in West Africa. This is probably around about 10 or 15 years ago now, where it was the notion began to be spread around that there were certain strangers that were visiting people's villages. And if this stranger visited your village and you shook hands with the stranger, it would make your penis disappear. And these people were known as penis thieves. And there were then a spate of murders where people who were just ordinary travellers would go to a village where the fear of the penis thieves existed, and would be quite friendly and try to greet people by shaking them by the hands. And this would then result in the person they were trying to befriend reacting very violently for fear of losing their penis and attacking them and killing them. And so, you know, this kind of superstition does still exist in Africa to a great extent.
That's quite bizarre. The penis thieves, yeah, the albinos, they're like an endangered species, aren't they? They have to have special places where they hide them, and a lot of them are maimed, where they've had bits of them cut off so that they can use them for this juju magic. So you know, Baden Powell and the British Army, they were facing quite a serious threat from these savages if they got any of those ideas into their heads, which they did from this particular witch doctor, this Malemo. The Malemo planned to wait until the night of the 29th of March, the first full moon, to take Bulawayo's city by surprise, immediately after a ceremony called the Big Dance. He promised, through his priests, that if the Matabele went to war, the bullets of the settlers would change to water and their cannon shells would become eggs. His plan was to kill all of the settlers in Bulawayo first, but not to destroy the town itself, as it would serve again as the royal kraal for the newly reincarnated King Lobengula. So, you know, we see these crazy ideas that these Africans would have. And, of course, the bullets wouldn't turn to water, the cannon shells wouldn't become eggs, but they would still continue to believe in this. And they would still fight. I mean, it's beyond me how they can, you know, how they can believe in these things, but apparently they do. On the 20th of March, go on.
Oh no, I was just chuckling. Really, I mean, the other more recent case was, I can't think of the name of the South African politician, but one of the new one of the politicians in South Africa that have taken over since apartheid was abolished, believed that if a man had sex with a virgin, that it would cure him of AIDS. Do you recall that story?
Yeah, that was a common one, wasn't it? I mean, that was really horrific, actually, because you know, because of the sexually active at such a young age, that actually resulted in a lot of infant rape, and you would get people that had got AIDS that would then go and rape an infant because they thought that it would cure them. And that's actually why South Africa has the worst amount of that of anywhere in the world, and they actually have school plays that they do with that as the subject of the school play in order to deter people from actually doing it. I mean, it's absolutely horrific, some of these superstitions that they have over there. And, you know, they still have hold on them. Obviously, they had hold on them back then in 1896, and they still have a hold of them now here in 2019. Well, on the 20th of March, the Matabele rebels shot and stabbed a native policeman. So one of their own, and nearly 2,000 Matabele warriors began the rebellion in earnest on the 24th of March. Many, although not all, of the young native police quickly deserted and joined the enemy. The Matabele headed into the countryside armed with a variety of weapons, including Martin Henry rifles, Winchester repeaters, Lee Metfords, assagais, knobkerries, and battle axes. As news of the massive rebellion spread, the Shona joined in the fighting, and the settlers headed towards Bulawayo. Within a week, 141 settlers were slain in Matabele land, another 103 killed in Mashona land, and hundreds of homes, ranches, and mines were burned. A particularly tragic case occurred at the Nsiza River, where Mrs. Fourey and her six small children were found mutilated beyond recognition on their farmstead. Two young women of the Ross family living nearby were similarly killed in their newly built home. And again, you know, this reminds me of what is going on today over there in South Africa with the farmers that are being slain. It also brings up questions of the loyalties that these natives have when they're in our army. When you've got all these Muslims that are in our army. I mean, this shows us that even though they had all these Negroes that were in the army, they had Negroes that were in the police, as soon as there was a Negro uprising among these Matabeles, they all deserted and joined the Matabeles. And you would think we would have learnt from this, but no, you know, we still allow all these different peoples to become a part of the British Army. And, you just think, well, what if these Muslims were to rise up? You know, all the Muslims that are in the army would go and join these other Muslims, wouldn't they?
Yeah, there would be a great danger of that, obviously, yeah.
I think another point with this as well, the weapons that they're using. Martini Henry rifles, Winchester repeaters, Lee Metfords, were they invented by the Africans, were they? Was that African technology? No, that was the white man's technology, and the white man had sold them these weapons, which were then being used against them. Not such a good idea to share our technology with these other races, is it really? Well, nearly 1,000 women and children were crowded into the city, and false alarms of attacks were common. Although they kept up their siege, the Matabele made one critical error. They neglected to cut the telegraph lines connecting Bulawayo to Mafeking, and this gave both the relief forces and the besieged Bulawayo field force far more information than they would otherwise have had. And again, that's typical Negro thinking there, isn't it? You know, they haven't worked out that these telegraph lines up ahead are actually connecting these places together so that they can talk to
understanding the technology.
Yeah. They just know these sticks we've given them go bang and they kill people, but they haven't worked out how the telegraph works yet. Well, the siege was eventually relieved. Several relief columns were organised to break the siege, but the long trek through hostile countryside took several months. Late in May, the first two relief columns appeared near Bulawayo on almost the same day, but from opposite directions. Cecil Rhodes and Colonel Beale were arriving from 300 miles to the north, and Lord Grey and Colonel Plumer were from 600 miles to the south. Now, I find this interesting because, you know, I've looked at Cecil Rhodes before and I've sort of seen him as this, as this imperialist and a money man and something to do with the Rothschilds. But hearing him about him in this, it's like he's, you know, he's a part of the army and he's, you know, he's actually fighting as a part of the army on the side of these troops. And it sort of changed my opinion of him a bit. What do you think of Cecil Rhodes, Max?
Well, I think Cecil Rhodes was an adventurer, really. You know, he was a real life Indiana Jones kind of character. He wasn't looking for archaeological artifacts, though. He was looking, he was going out seeking adventure and exploring Africa. And he did get a fair bit of his financing from the De Beers Company and from the Rothschilds, but in order to attract that funding, he needed to find gold and he needed to find diamonds, which he did, and so lived up to his obligations in that respect. But he also had an idea of civilizing Africa in the way that you've suggested, by spreading the railways and enabling Europeans to go out and settle in Africa, so that the land could be utilized. And not only that, he amassed a vast fortune whilst he was doing all this, and then came back to the UK and sponsored the Rhodes scholarships that are to be had in Oxford University now. And so there are many, many thousands of people who have benefited from the Rhodes scholarships to pay their way through university. And so in that respect, you know, he may well have been a bit of a buccaneer on occasions. He may well have, because of the necessities of the situation that he was in, may have done things that we perhaps wouldn't necessarily have approved of today. But in the round, I think he should be regarded as somebody who was a heroic character and whose contribution to the development of our nation was considerable.
He seemed to be very loyal to Britain as well. I mean, he had a secret plan to try and get America to be a part of the British Empire, and he wanted to see Anglos rule the world, basically. He thought that Anglos were in the best position to lead the world with their sense of justice and their sense of law, and he was very upset that America had broken apart from Britain, and he wanted America to become a part of the British Empire again and to have us rule the world, basically. And I think some of these Rhodes scholarships, it was hoped that once these people had got all their qualifications, that they would work towards that, and their loyalty would be to the British Empire. And of course, today you've got a lot of these Africans that actually get these Rhodes scholarships, and then when they get to the university, they try to tear down the statues of Cecil Rhodes, and they have this movement, the Rhodes Must Fall movement, you know, biting the hand that feeds them. Basically, it's an interesting time. All these famous characters of history, and they were actually involved in action and activities like this. Getting back to our story here, military intelligence at the time thought that capturing the witch doctor would be the speediest way to end the war. The location of his squalid cave had been disclosed to the native commissioner at Mangwe by an unnamed Zulu informant. Military Commander General Carrington instructed Burnham, Armstrong, and Chief of Staff Baden-Powell to leave that very night to capture the Malemo if you can, kill him if you must, do not let him escape. So we've got Baden-Powell there, and we've got Burnham, the American scout. Baden-Powell, he actually got diverted, and it was actually it was Burnham, the chief, the American scout, that actually got this Malemo. Once inside the cave, they waited until Malemo entered, and once he started his dance of immunity, Burnham shot him just below the heart, killing him. The men then leapt over the dead Malemo and ran down a trail towards their horses. Hundreds of Negro savages encamped nearby picked up their arms and started in pursuit. Burnham set fire to the village as a distraction, and the men hurried back to Bulawayo with the Negroes in hot pursuit. Upon learning of the death of Malemo, Cecil Rhodes walked unarmed into the Matabele stronghold and persuaded the Matabele warriors to lay down their arms and give up. I mean, you can't really imagine a banker doing something like that today, can you? Walking into it unarmed. I mean, it's quite a heroic story there, I think. I'm quite surprised at Cecil Rhodes here. Well, we actually got some quotes from Baden-Powell about what he thought when he took part in this war, if I can just find them here on my computer. And these quotes, actually, they come from a book written by a Jewish character, Michael Rosenthal, his name is, and normally he writes children's stories. He's quite a degenerate character, and this book that he's written is basically all about attacking Baden-Powell, but it has got some really juicy quotes from him, which show us what he was like. This is the first one, and this is Baden-Powell on his memories of this Matabele War. The native was apparently incapable of grasping any idea of punctuality. Lying was the natural form of every statement or promise he made. Lying was the natural attitude assumed by his body, especially when any work was to be done. Moreover, in the present instance, the trade gin of the metropolis had come sweet to the lips of the countryman just called up from his village, and his natural stupidity was therefore rendered doubly dense. One good point about these warriors was their cowardice. The least hint of an intention of backing up an order with force ensured its prompt obedience. So he was quite assured of the superiority of the white man, and he was quite used to how these blacks actually were. And I think that was probably characteristic of most people at that time. You know, they understood that these people were different to them. They had no idea that they were, you know, they were the same as them.
I think it goes without saying that they would have had that attitude. It's only nowadays, after decades and decades of brainwashing with regard to equality, that people need to be reminded that There are significant differences between average differences between the various races.
And it didn't stop him trying to help them. I mean, once he'd actually set the scouts up, he did set up a special unit of scouts for blacks and a special unit of scouts for Indians. And, you know, they had this idea that all men are equal, but the blacks and the Indians weren't quite just yet equal. So they needed to be treated in a different way. And I think that was generally how most people thought until after the war. And then this idea came in that, oh no, they actually are equal and we can allow them into our countries, because, you know, there's always this, this idea that they were equal and they were citizens of the British Empire. You know, they could come to Britain, but they don't. We'd rather they didn't. On paper, they could, but in reality, they couldn't. And that sort of changed after the war. I got another quote here from him. The stupid inertness of the puzzled Negro is duller than that of an ox. A dog would grasp your meaning in one half the time. Men and brothers, they may be brothers, but they certainly are not men. And I think that's a reference to the anti-slavery propaganda, which was, there's quite a famous piece of that, which says something like, I'm a man and a brother and you shouldn't treat me this way. Something like that. So he's saying they may be brothers, but they certainly are not men, not in the sense of the way that a white man is. And he also gave us an insight into the slavery that was going on at the time. Don't forget, this is at a time when slavery was supposed to have been stopped, and it was stopped in America. He said, wherever there is a good market for them, it is to the interest of the owner to keep them well fed and in good condition. In those parts where domestic slavery prevails, there is often little or no hardship. An occasional lick from a whip is to an unintelligent savage but a small matter, where in the opposite scale he has the very substantial compensation of protection, food, and a home, advantages which are not always shared by his white brother when fate has frowned upon him and has turned him into the cold to work out his living among the unemployed. And, you know, and that's a point that I've made quite a lot is, you know, they will complain about slavery, but these slaves, they were fed, they had protection, they had welfare, they had a home. And at the same time, we had white people that were starving that couldn't get work. So I think it's good that Baden-Powell is making that point as well.
Yeah.
He also says the worst part of slavery is, as a rule, the hardship entailed in the slave caravan marches, which have to be conducted at a forced pace over desert and devious routes in order to avoid the good intentions of the European anti-slavery forces. So again, that, you know, it tells us what was going on at the time, that the British were trying to do away with slavery, but in actual fact, these slaves led better lives than many whites did at the time, and certainly better lives than the Africans. Do you want to comment on that, Max, before we move on to the next section?
Only that there are often calls nowadays for people who were sold into slavery, or the descendants of people who were sold into slavery, for them to be compensated for the fact their ancestors had been slaves. And yet, if we look at the people who are the descendants of the slaves who were transported from Africa across to the United States, those descendants now have an infinitely greater standard of living than the people who were left behind and who weren't actually sold into slavery. And so one might question whether there's a need for compensation at all.
And, those slaves were bought fair and square. They were bought from the African chiefs. They were paid for. If the Africans today want compensation, they should be going to their own African chiefs and saying, well, look, you're the guy that sold me, so where's the money that was paid for me? You know, nobody mentions that. Well, is it Baden-Powell's inspiration for scouting actually came about during this Second Matabele War? It was during the Second Matabele War, under Chief of Staff Carrington, that Baden-Powell first met and began a lifelong friendship with Frederick Russell Burnham, the American-born Chief of Scouts for the British. This would become a formative experience for Baden-Powell, not only because he had the time of his life commanding reconnaissance missions into enemy territory, but because many of his later Boy Scout ideas took hold here, Burnham had been a scout practically his entire life in the United States when he went to Africa in 1893 to scout for Cecil Rhodes on the Cape to Cairo Railway. As chief of scouts under Major Alan Wilson, Burnham became known in Africa as He Who Sees in the Dark, and he gained fame in the First Matabele War when he survived the British equivalent of Custer's last stand, the Shanghai Patrol. Have you ever heard of that, Max? I didn't actually research that one, the Shanghai Patrol.
No, that's a new one to me.
Yeah, I looked into most of these, but I must have missed that one. During their joint scouting patrols into the Matabo Hills, Burnham began teaching Baden-Powell woodcraft, inspiring him and giving him the plan for both the program and the code of honor of scouting for boys. Practiced by frontiersmen of the American Old West and the Red Indians, woodcraft was generally unknown to the British, but well known to the American scout Burnham. These skills eventually formed the basis of what is now called scoutcraft, the fundamentals of scouting. Both men recognised that wars in Africa were changing markedly and the British Army needed to adapt. So during their joint scouting missions, Baden-Powell and Burnham discussed the concept of a broad training programme in woodcraft for young men, rich in exploration, tracking, fieldcraft and self-reliance. It was also during this time in the Matabo Hills that Baden-Powell first started to wear his signature campaign hat like the one worn by Burnham, and it was here that Baden-Powell acquired his kudu horn, the Matabele war instrument he later used every morning at Brownsea Island to wake the first Boy Scouts and to call them together in training courses. And apparently this Burnham, this chief scout for the British, he was brought up on a Red Indian reservation. I mean, he was white, but he learned a lot of his skills from there. And obviously they sort of transferred over to Baden-Powell and they taught the army them. And then they later went on to teach the children them. And as you were pointing out earlier, Max, a large part of this was self-reliance, teaching people to be self-sufficient and self-reliant. So it was really during that Second Matabele War that he really got this idea of scouting into his head. But unfortunately, he was accused of wrongdoing. Baden-Powell was accused of illegally executing a prisoner of war in 1896, the Matabele chief Uwini, who had been promised his life would be spared if he surrendered. Uwini was sentenced to be shot by firing squad by military court, a sentence Baden-Powell confirmed. Baden-Powell was cleared via military court of inquiry, but the colonial civil authorities wanted a civil investigation and trial. Baden-Powell later claimed he was released without a stain on my character. Baden-Powell was also accused of allowing native African warriors under his command to massacre enemy prisoners, including women, children, and non-combatants. And I'll just stop there, because the very fact that they had a civil investigation into this and a trial to see whether this prisoner of war was illegally executed shows that the colonial powers were not mistreating the natives, and they took it very seriously if the rules of war were ignored and somebody was illegally executed, I think.
Yeah, it demonstrates that the British soldiers and the British authorities in Africa weren't just going around shooting natives willy-nilly, which is often the impression that the descendants of those natives try to give, because if that was the case, then there would have been none of these trials that were held, and nobody would have batted an eyelid that a prisoner of war had been killed. I think that, and this is one thing that I emphasize to people whenever wars are discussed, that a war is a process whereby two sides decide that they're going to inflict violence on the other in order to terrorize them into submitting to the stronger's dominance, and wars cause all sorts of terrible things to happen, and I don't think there's probably a war that's ever been held where there hasn't been a war crime of one sort or another that's happened. But that doesn't mean to say that all wars and all the participants in those wars have never had any kind of scruples. You know, very often war crimes are committed as incidental incidents that happened that weren't planned, that weren't approved of by the authorities, etc. And if they are discovered and if they are reported, then they get investigated. And that the very fact that Baden-Powell was investigated twice for this allegation of killing a prisoner of war, you know, indicates that you know, that system did apply, so that the soldiers and the authorities in Africa at the time, you know, would behave in a an upright and proper manner. I think it also shows, though, the fact that the civil authorities weren't content to allow the matter to be dealt with at court-martial, that the civil authorities were already at that point in time infected to some extent by the same liberalism that infects our court systems today, and which are subjecting now retired pensioners who previously were members of the parachute regiment to prosecution in Northern Ireland over what is allegedly called Bloody Sunday.
That's a really good point, that. It's a really good point. It's dreadful what they're doing today, prosecuting them. It shows you there was legal recourse for these natives, and there was no carte blanche to just do with them whatever the white people wanted to. And it was the white people that were taking other whites to court for the mistreatment here. And thankfully, he was found innocent. After Rhodesia, Baden-Powell served in the Fourth Ashanti War on the Gold Coast. In 1897, at the age of 40, he was breveted colonel, and he was the youngest colonel in the British Army. He was given command of the 5th Dragoon Guards in India. A few years later, he wrote a small manual entitled Aids to Scouting, a summary of lectures he had given on the subject of military scouting, much of it written a written explanation of the lessons he had learned from Burnham to help train recruits. Using this and other methods, he was able to train them to think independently, use their initiative, and survive in the wilderness. And of course, that was the basis for the scouting for boys, which would come later on. I mean, really, he was publishing this stuff, and while he was actually there in Africa, scouting was already taking off in Britain without him really knowing about it. It was when he came back to Britain, he sort of discovered it. But we've got more military excitement to go through yet before we get to that. The next bit we've got is the Siege of Mafeking. Baden-Powell returned to South Africa before the Second Boer War and was engaged in further military actions against the Zulus. Although instructed to maintain a mobile mounted force on the frontier with the Boer Republics, Baden-Powell amassed stores and a garrison at Mafeking. While engaged in this, he and much of his intended mobile force was at Mafeking when it was surrounded by a Boer army, at times in excess of 8,000 men. And I think he had good reason for staying where he was, because the force that he had weren't actually that well trained. So that was his reason for this. And Baden-Powell was, go on, do you want to say something there, Matt?
I was just going to say that I think the force that he had was around about 500 men that were drawn from a number of different sources. So they were men who hadn't been trained to as one single unit, that they were drawn from, as I say, from some were Australians, I think some of them were perhaps New Zealanders and things of that sort, and only a very small number of them were Britain. Also, the other thing I'd just like to sort of point out to you is that I pronounce it Mafeking, and I think that is the proper way of pronouncing.
Yeah, I'm not sure of the correct. Not sure of the correct pronunciation. Mafeking. Mafeking. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what was I going to say? I was just going to say there about the Boers as well. Obviously, you know, these Boer wars, there was a lot of bad behaviour on the part of the British with these concentration camps and putting the women and the children in them and starving them. But at the same time, you've got to think, you know, you had brave men like these 500 men that were here in this siege of Mafeking fighting against these Boers, you know, and you've got to have loyalty to your country, and you've got to try and win the war. That is essentially what it's all about, is winning this war and trying to keep to the rules of law as well, as we were saying earlier with this, you know, with this trial of Baden-Powell. Baden-Powell was the garrison commander during the subsequent siege of Mafeking, which lasted 217 days. Although Baden-Powell could have destroyed his stores and had sufficient forces to break out throughout much of the siege, especially since the Boers lacked adequate artillery to shell the town or its forces, he remained in the town to the point of his intended mounted soldiers eating their own horses. And so I think this, you know, this is probably because most of his men were untrained and they were recruited from among the population before the siege. That's why he didn't try to break out. But you imagine how bad that is, you know, the starvation had got, where they were having to eat their horses. And, you know, he was very careful with the rationing to make certain that they were able to last all this time. You think 217 days for a siege. I mean, that's pretty savage. But the morale of the civilian population was given attention, and Sunday ceasefires were negotiated so that sports, competitions and theatrical performances could be held. Notable were the cricket matches held on a Sunday. Initially, the religious sensibilities of General J.P. Snyman in command of the Boer army were offended, and he threatened to fire upon the players if they continued. But eventually, Snyman relented and even invited the British to a game. Baden-Powell replied that first he had to finish the present match, in which the score was 200 days, not out. And this, this reminds me of It Ain't Half Hot, Mum. Do you remember that comedy series? I mean, this was really what it was like. You know, they negotiated a ceasefire on Sunday so that they could play cricket and they would have theatrical performances. And try to keep the morale of the people up. He understood that it was important to do that. And it shows you that they were gentlemen. You know, they could,
chivalry. Still the age of chivalry in those days, where civilians were not to be attacked in any warfare. And it's just a shame, really, that during the 20th century, that rule seems to have now disappeared. And warring various combatants seem to regard the civilians of either side, basically, which is very sad.
And you got the sportsmanship thing as well. You know, in the First World War, where they stopped to have a game of football, and sport. Yep, that's right. You know, it comes to the forefront, and everybody shares a love of sport, and it's a way of breaking down these barriers. So, you know, have a ceasefire on a Sunday. Again, it reminds me of things that you hear about how, you know, when the British were fighting the French, they would stop for afternoon tea and then they would start again. And you think, even going back thousands of years ago, they had rules of war where they would stop for a break and they would all amass on one side on the other. And it was all regimented when they would actually start and then they would stop and people would be able to go in and fetch the wounded and bring them back, and they'd stop and they'd have a bite to eat, and then they'd start again at a certain time the next day, you know, with a call of a horn or whatever. It was all very civilized compared to the way that it goes on today. Well, the siege of the small town received undue attention from both the Boers and the international media, because Lord Edward Cecil, the son of the British Prime Minister, was also besieged in the town. The garrison held out until relieved, in part thanks to cunning deceptions, many devised by Baden-Powell. Fake landmines were laid around the town in view of the Boers and their spies within the town, and his soldiers were ordered to simulate avoiding barbed wire, which was non-existent, when moving between trenches. Guns and a searchlight, and the searchlight was improvised from an acetylene lamp and a biscuit tin, were moved around the town to increase their apparent number. A howitzer was built in Mafeking's railway workshops, and even an old cannon, dated 1770, which coincidentally had BP and Co. engraved on the barrel, was pressed into service. Noticing that the Boers had failed to remove any of the railway tracks, the British commander had an armoured train from Mafeking rail yard, loaded with sharpshooters, armed with Martini Henry Mark IV rifles, sent up the rail line in a daring attack right into the heart of the Boer camp, followed by a return to Mafeking. The casualties made this Baden-Powell's only attempt at an all-out assault on the enemy. Often, British soldiers had to dress as women just to undertake normal activities such as fetching water and sewing to deceive the enemy. So again, it's like this, it ain't half hot mum, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
This is Baden-Powell's ingenuity here. A bit of a pantomime there, and very, very British, I would suggest. Making up fake lamps and trying to deceive the enemy into thinking that there's a lot more going on than there actually was. And I guess this probably helped out with the Cub Scouts as well. You know, when you're a Cub Scout, yeah, you got to use the imagination and, you know, make do with what you've got, basically. During the siege, the Mafeking Cadet Corps of white boys below fighting age stood guard, carried messages, assisted in hospitals, and so on, freeing the grown men to fight. He was sufficiently impressed with both their courage and the equanimity with which they performed their tasks to use them later as an object lesson in the first chapter of Scouting for Boys. So that's interesting as well. They had these boys there doing that, and that influenced him. The siege was lifted on the 16th of May 1900. Baden-Powell was promoted to Major General and became a national hero. However, the British military commanders were more critical of his performance and even less impressed with his subsequent choices to again allow himself to be besieged. Ultimately, his failure to properly understand the situation and his abandonment of soldiers, mostly Australian and Rhodesian, in the Battle of Elands River led to his being removed from action. And I actually had a look into this at what happened at Elands River. And in that instance, he was sent to rescue soldiers that were under siege. But after scouting the area, he abandoned the mission, as it would have left them all isolated. And he was also under the impression that the troops had already surrendered, but they had in fact refused to surrender, citing their nationalities as Australians and Rhodesians as reason enough never to surrender, no matter what the terms are. And I thought that was interesting, because this Boer leader was actually, he offered them good terms of surrender, but they just refused. They said Australians don't surrender and Rhodesians won't surrender either. And there you go. You still had this strong sense of patriotism back there. And modern critics have suggested that Baden-Powell's success during the siege in resisting the Boers was secured at the expense of the lives of the native African soldiers and civilians, including members of his own African garrison. One researcher, Pakenham, stated that Baden-Powell drastically reduced the rations to the native garrison. However, in 2001, after subsequent research, Pakenham decidedly retreated from this position. So we see once again that they're trying to besmirch him and smear him. And to be quite honest, you know, he would be quite right to reduce the rations of the Africans and to ensure that there was enough, you know, for the white men, for the ones that had the training, for the ones that could actually fight. So I think he would have been quite right to actually do that. I mean, he did well enough to think ahead so that he rationed enough food for them to last over 200 days. I think that's a long time. Was it 200 days in this one? Or was it 200 days in the last one? Just trying to look here. You want to comment on that, Max?
I was just saying it was 217 days with the siege of Mafeking, but I'm not sure how long it was with the Battle of Elands River.
Oh, the Battle of Elands River. Yeah, that was part of this. I think that was part of this or just after this happened. It was just after Mafeking that he went over to Elands River. It was just like a comment in this description of it. And I thought, well, I'd better go and have a look there and see what happened. See what the allegation was.
So, yeah, it goes to show that, you know, despite the fact that we are celebrating Baden-Powell today, that, you know, he wasn't a man whose record was totally spotless. You know, he did things that weren't so highly regarded by the military top brass, and this is perhaps a feature of the attitude of the military, where I think as far as the British Army was concerned, the British Army tended to favour what was termed blind obedience, whereas as weaponry changed and things like machine guns came into effect, and so that instead of there being set piece battles as there had been in the past, in which case blind obedience was something which could be defended from a rational perspective. When you had fast flowing kind of battle situations where the lie of the land, the position of the enemy could change quite significantly from hour to hour, then what was needed by soldiers, if they were to be effective in the field, was what became known as intelligent obedience, where they set off with the intention of carrying out their orders to the word, but were allowed the commander in the field was allowed a degree of latitude so that they could change their orders in order to adapt to the changed circumstances that they actually encountered once they got into the battle. And I think as far as the Battle of Elands River is concerned, Baden-Powell set off with the intention of relieving the ammunition dump at Elands River, but part of the way there, you know, the intelligence that he gathered with the troops that he had was, as you say, that the battle had passed, and that if they continued towards Elands River, that they may find themselves isolated and surrounded by the enemy as well. And so he took the initiative of deciding to withdraw, which then brought into question his leadership. And so that's why he was then under investigation once the incident was over.
Yeah, initiative was very important. Again, you bring up a good point there. Again, that ties in with the Boy Scouting thing, this initiative, and the changes in the military side of things, and the changes in war, and the changes in battle, and you know, this was at a time where the natives were starting to get hold of all this technology, and there was changes there as well, as we will see later on in some of these quotes where he's talking about the natives and how they are today from back when he was fighting with them in Africa and how they were in the early 20th century. Well, on his
it was also a matter, as far as the Boers were concerned, the Boers had horses, they had cavalry that could move very quickly. They were Europeans, and so they had European weaponry as well, so that they could defend themselves. And lots of the Boer men were farmers and trackers, and so they were very highly trained in they knew the land very intimately, and they were trained in tracking and living off the land. And so they lots of the Boer forces were actually guerrilla forces that didn't fight conventional warfare in the way that the British Army had done, and so what was required was the ability on the part of the people who were commanding the British forces right at the sharp end for them to adapt the orders that had been given to the changing circumstances that they encountered in the field. And that's the thing, that it took a long time for the British Army to actually fully appreciate that at the highest levels. And so we had the situation where, because we're talking here around about 1900, the turn of the century, 1901 for the Battle of Elands River, we're talking about a time which was 20 years, not full 20 years. It was 14 years or so until the First World War. And even during the First World War, there was this this expectation on the part of the senior military in this country to expect blind obedience. And it was during the First World War that and during the Second World War, really, that British forces realized that they had to apply this principle of intelligent obedience rather than just blind obedience.
They had a formidable foe there, you know, against those Boers. It's not like being up against the Matabele savages. You got 8,000 Boers there, and Baden-Powell and his 500 men besieged and having to dress up as women to distract the Boers. Right. Well,
yeah, that's amazing.
On his return from Africa, Baden-Powell found that his military training manual, Aids to Scouting, had become a bestseller and was being used by teachers and youth organisations, including Charlotte Mason's House of Education. Following his involvement in the Boys' Brigade as a brigade vice president and officer in charge of its scouting section, with encouragement from his friend William Alexander Smith, Baden-Powell decided to rewrite Aids to Scouting to suit a youth readership. In August 1907, he held a camp on Brownsea Island to test out his ideas. About 20 boys attended, 8 from the local boys' brigade companies, and about 12 public school boys, mostly sons of his friends. The first book on the Scout movement, Baden-Powell's Scouting for Boys, was published in 6 instalments in 1908 and has sold approximately 150 million copies as the 4th best-selling book of the 20th century. Boys spontaneously formed Scout troops and the Scouting movement inadvertently started, first as a national and soon as an international phenomenon. So that was when it really started. Once he got back there, and the Boys' Brigade had been around for a while, but the Boys' Brigade had, I think, it had more of a Christian feel to it. I think that was the real difference. And this bit on, you know, always doing your best and improvement of character and a scout's honor and all of that sort of thing, that was new to scouting, basically. Do you want to comment on the start of this scouting movement, or shall I move on to some more of these quotes of his thoughts on these other races at the time, Max?
Well, let's move on to that, because I don't really have a great deal of knowledge of the Boys' Brigade, to be quite honest. My recollection of the Boys' Brigade, because both the Boys' Brigade and the Scout movement existed side by side when I was a boy, and I was never a member of the Boys' Brigade, but my recollection is that they were certainly in the area where I lived. They were more naval oriented than they were infantry, if you see what I mean. And so, I think that may have been a key difference.
Yeah, I might have played into it as well. We've got some idea of how Baden-Powell saw the role of the white man here. He says, and this is talking about the black man, but however good they may be, they must, as a people, be ruled with a hand of iron in a velvet glove. And if they writhe under it and don't understand the force of it, it is no use to add more padding. You must take off the glove for a moment and show them the hand. They will then understand and obey. So he's saying, you know, you've got to, you know, you've got to punish these people when they do wrong, and it's got to be immediate. You know, and this ties in with this idea that they don't actually have words for abstract thoughts in the African language. They're not. It's not very easy for them to imagine the consequences of their actions. So there needs to be punishment straight away. You know, these slave masters knew this as well, that they needed to be instantly punished. And he's got a comment here about one of the virtues of a loyal native scout. Discussing the virtues of a loyal native scout, Jan Grootboom, who served him well, Baden-Powell cites the testimony of an approving white scout. Quote, "As one of Gray's scouts and one who loathed the ordinary kafir said of him, he is not a proper nigger, his skin is black, but he has a white man's heart. I will shake hands with him." Now, you know, that may seem racist to us today, but in actual fact, I mean, he's not saying that. He's saying, you know, these people, normally they behave badly, but this one behaved well. And to credit him with the ultimate accolade, I will say that he has a white man's heart, and I will shake hands with him and treat him as a white man, which I think shows, you know, it's good quality to his character.
Yeah, I think as far as Baden-Powell was concerned, he wasn't without respect for the good that he saw in the native peoples. And when we spoke earlier, I mentioned to you about a quote that I saw written in one of the various books that Bowden Powell had written for the Scout movement, and I can't remember which book it is, and I don't actually have the quote to hand, sadly, but the gist of it was that he spoke about one of the tribes that he had contact with in Africa who, as part of their manhood ceremony and as a kind of a rite of passage into manhood, would take a boy who perhaps would be a teenager, and the boy would then be required to strip naked, and the village people would then smear white paint all over him. And this would be a kind of white paint that they made. I don't know quite what they made it from, but this apparently this white paint would take, no matter what you did, it would take about a month for it to wear off. And so they would smear this the youth with white paint. They would give the youth a native spear, an assegai, and give him a shield, and then send him off into the wilderness on his own to fend for himself for a month. The boy was allowed to return to the tribe once all the white paint had worn off, but if the boy returned to the tribe before the white paint had worn off, then they would be attacked and punished by the tribe. So the boys basically just had to go and fend for themselves for an entire month. They had no shelter, they had no clothing, they had no way of lighting a fire apart from like rubbing sticks together, and so they took a tremendous amount of resourcefulness for those that survived to actually do that. And but apparently when the boys came back, once all the white paint had worn off, then they were warmly welcomed by the tribe and were then regarded as men and as warriors of the tribe, and so were accorded great respect. And this is something that Baden-Powell felt was quite admirable, and it felt that to some extent the scouting movement should seek to inculcate within our youth the same sort of degree of self-reliance that these native boys had to develop in order to survive that that rite of passage into manhood. And so that again is then an example of Baden-Powell not denigrating the natives unnecessarily, but being prepared to recognize in them when he saw it effectively.
Yeah, he certainly had respect for them where respect was due, and he knew the difference between men as well, white men. I mean, there's an image in his book. It's got a white man and a man, and the white man is like a sort of Aryan Superman, and the person that's just a man is just sort of unshaven and a little bit unkempt and not the picture of health that it should be. So if you're a white man, you've got a lot to live up to. You've got to live up to your full potential. I've got another quote here about a competent, courageous native. Yes, Jan had proved himself a white man, if in black skin. White and black then embody sharply opposed moral aggregates. The only way to account for the admirable native in such a system is to assume that within the black skin lurks a white heart or head or guts. To be a white man constitutes for Baden-Powell a potent shorthand for describing what is best in people. By gentleman, I don't mean a toff with white spats and eyeglass and money, but a white man, a fellow whose honour you can rely upon through thick and thin, to deal straight, to be chivalrous, and to be helpful. The view of the black man, as at best ineffectual and childlike, at worst savage, corrupt, and indolent, remained constant throughout Baden-Powell's life. His position as chief scout and his experiences as a world traveller did nothing to alter his sharply honed sense of the vast difference between white and black. And I'll just interject there because there is a vast difference. And you know, all these experiences are what led to Baden-Powell's views upon it. A difference that he suggested even animals appreciated. In Indian Memories, Baden-Powell reminisces about the young wild boar who lived in his compound and would come out when food was brought. I think he knew the difference between a white man and a black, for when I offered it to him, he would approach very suspiciously and make snaps at the food and dart away again. When, however, my native servant took the food out, the little brute went straight for him, cutting at his legs with diminutive tusks. So, you know, he could see the difference. And this book here is trying to make out that, you know, it's bad of him to think like this. But his way of thinking came from his experience. It came from going all around the world and seeing this. This young boar was apparently as capable of the same keen discrimination as a dog in Africa, who, finding himself thirsty and without his master, took his bowl in his mouth and made his way to the magistrate's office in the town, where he knew there would be a white man, therefore a friend to animals. The message he always conveyed to the scout readers of his books is how inferior and primitive the black is wherever he is to be found. In Boy Scouts Beyond the Seas, he points out that in Australia, the current blacks, who replaced a cowardly, murderous lot who fell back before the whites, are not quite like other Negroes, and they have a great deal of hair, and their foreheads are low and come very forward over the eyes, so that they are even plainer than the African nigger, and he is no beauty. Like the Bushmen, the lowest type of native in Africa, some of them live in a sort of nest, without having the sense to build themselves huts. They are almost like monkeys, and yet in both countries they draw very good pictures on the rocks with coloured chalks and charcoal. I love that bit at the end there, with the coloured chalks and charcoal. The Australian Negroes, living almost like monkeys, are not terribly different from the Aborigines, who inhabit a group of Gulf Islands, an absolutely wild, uneducated people who know nothing about law or civilization, living almost like animals, but not quite. They have rules and customs of their own. They have not proper religion, but they believe that they have a little body inside their body. Both of these can be contrasted with the Filipino natives, a dark but civilized race, nice, but inclined to be rather lazy, so they don't make as much out of their country as the more energetic white men do. You know, I think, you know, this shows us a good idea of, you know, he had a good grasp of the difference between the races, and also a good grasp of, you know, the white man's role as being a leading light to these races, as somebody to set a good example, to be chivalrous and you know, be honourable. And eventually these other races might eventually, you know, become an equal to the white man. But they definitely weren't equal at this time. And I think that was the general feeling all around. Do you want to make any comments on those quotes, Max?
Well, I generally agree with the gist of what you're saying. I think as far as Africa is concerned, the IQ testing that was done by Professor Richard Lynn and his colleagues to produce the books that he has showed that the average IQ of Africans south of the Sahara is significantly lower than the average IQ of Europeans. And but that doesn't mean to say that there aren't any intelligent people in Africa of African origin at all. It's just that they are a much smaller proportion of the population than people of the same level of intelligence would represent within a European population. And certainly in those times, the most of the Africans that would have been encountered by Baden-Powell and other European explorers would have been people who had never ever seen anything of white technology in the past, and so therefore they would have been, it would have all be totally mystifying for them, and would to some extent appear like magic. And so we can appreciate how superstitious people who have never encountered any kind of advanced technology at all would appear to be entirely different to the Europeans that they were suddenly presented with.
Yeah, there's not a trace of hatred there for these other races. They just are what they are, and he's interested in them. And I think also the bit there where he's mentioning about the dog and the way that animals react to them, I mean, that is a thing. Dogs, you know, they don't really like being around Negroes for some reason. You do hear of them being treated very badly by them. And, you know, where he says that the dog knew that if he could get to the magistrate's house, he would find a friend because it was a white man. And of course, 99% of all the vets in the world are white men. It's white people that care about animals. I think he was very, very attuned to the differences between the races. It's no surprise that he does get attacked today, but, you know, it's still a credit to him that he is still the chief scout, and he is still very well honoured. But of course, you know, they've really dirtied the name of the scouts by allowing gay scoutmasters in and allowing girls to call themselves scouts, because of course his wife started up the Girl Guides. It was the Boy Scouts and the Girl Guides. And now they've allowed girls to join the scouts, which is, you know, it totally changed the entire feeling of it. You know, girls and boys are different. It should have been a boys' space, the Cub Scouts, as it was when I was a child. It's, you know, it's very sad that young boys today don't you know, have the opportunities that they would have had 30 or 40 years ago, in the same way that it's very sad that young men don't have the same opportunities that they had 120 years ago to, you know, go on these adventurous pursuits that we were talking about. Well, that pretty much brings us to the end of this episode, Max. We've still got some more there. We'll have a part three on Baden-Powell next week. So thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Aryan Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.
Radio Aryan, for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.